a trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. This is a program that exists for the purpose of encouraging and inspiring people to take ownership of their own worldview. I know it's a lot easier to just sit back and kind of passively absorb whatever's coming at you out of your computer screen or television screen or your telephone screen. I'm here to tell you that it is worth every bit of effort, every bit of sweat and toil to own your worldview by thinking as critically and as clearly and independently as you can about the information that you're taking in. And I'm very grateful to be one of the many voices out there trying to help point people towards the light. Not because I have all the answers, but because there were others who pointed the way to me. And I'm trying to pay that favor along to those who are following along, slogging their way out of the swamp of misinformation. Got some fun stuff to cover in this hour, too. We're going to talk about the idea of Elon Musk buying up and fixing some of the more woke corporations among us. We'll talk a little bit about whether your vote really does much to secure your liberty. I know I've pushed on this yesterday. I'm going to push on a little bit more today. Got a great article from Bertine Schaefer about the real reason libertarians don't matter. Also, we're going to talk about developing a solid work ethic. One of the best examples you can see of what a great work ethic looks like is that amazing dancer Fred Astaire and his incomparable dance skills. Plus, we'll talk about how to pick up on the telltale signs of a false flag operation. Just a list of some of the easy to recognize ones. And last but not least, we'll talk about how the question, are they really out to get me, can be answered both yes and no, depending on the level of bureaucracy that you're dealing with. Let's start by talking about why so many people seem supportive of Elon Musk buying up and fixing some of the more woke corporations among us. I mean, when he made his first overtures to take control and to purchase Twitter, one of the first things I started to see was people saying, hey, could you buy Coca-Cola? Could you buy Disney? Could you, you know, fix them as well? Robert E. Wright, writing for the American Institute for Economic Research, asks about a Musk-inspired anti-ESG takeover wave. And he says, it's fun to see memes suggesting that Elon Musk should buy Alphabet or Amazon or Coca-Cola, Disney, Meta, Netflix, YouTube, and so forth. But of course, he can't afford all of that. But we can. And he says, by we, I mean value investors. Now, Musk's purchase of Twitter has validated those critiques, and he gives you several examples, at least four of them, of ESG-based investment. That's environment, social, governance investment, which, despite its weak financial record, currently constitutes about $2.7 trillion globally. And as it has demonstrated the potential power of anti-ESG funds, which he has called the Friedman Funds after Milton Friedman. So an anti-ESG Friedman Fund would, firstly, short companies overvalued due to capricious or government-dictated ESG metrics, and buy companies undervalued due to said metrics. And secondly, buy controlling interest in potentially valuable companies that are going broke or at least earning less than they could because they went woke, as Musk and his investors recently did. Now, Robert Wright says the goal of the fund would be to earn above average risk-adjusted returns, period. But the effect of the fund would be to increase financial market efficiency and economic productivity by punishing deviations from rational valuations and rational business decision-making processes. See, this first approach, he says, is widely called value investing. Although understood in general terms by investors since at least the 18th century, Benjamin Graham popularized and quantified the approach in the first half of the 20th century. The gist is to buy stocks when their market price falls below their rational value, and to sell or short them when their market price exceeds their rational value. Value investors tend to buy and hold, ignoring daily price gyrations, so long as the market price remains rather near rational value, the price toward which the stock will gravitate in anything approaching an efficient market. Robert Wright says a stock's price might deviate somewhat from its rational value because investors like or hate the company because of what it makes or how it makes it or who runs it or something its executives say or do. In other words, the shares of presumably good companies can gain from a halo effect, while shares of allegedly bad companies sometimes languish due to a devil's horn effect. Some investors overestimate the importance of these various soft factors on other investors, causing them to value the stock higher, that's the halo, or lower, that's the horn, than the rational investor does. So ESG funds and ESG ratings, given regulatory teeth by the Securities and Exchange Commission directly or indirectly through bond rating agencies, could produce significant halo slash horn effects that value investors could exploit for their own gain while reducing financial system fragility in the process. Because ESG represents politicized and largely subjective concepts, ESG ratings can diverge significantly from reality. Unless checked by value investors, they could easily lead to bubbles, too much investment in certain assets like dot-coms or mortgage-backed securities, or anti-bubbles, too little investments in certain assets like fossil fuels. He says ESG bubbles could be particularly costly because the overinvestment might go into companies that actually hurt the environment or the downtrodden. As scholars like Ozzie Zehner, author of Green Illusions, have been arguing, and as Michael Moore tried to explain to fellow progressives in his 2019 documentary, Planet of the Humans, very few green technologies provide net environmental benefits because they're inefficient, rely on tax subsidies, and need rare earth metals to work, or have major environmental side effects, and so forth. Similarly, as recently pointed out by the Harvard Business Review, ESG ratings are not correlated with better environmental or labor regulatory compliance. Moreover, he says many social justice initiatives at major corporations, like many government programs, aid Democrat politicians, but do little or nothing to help American Indians, blacks, Hispanics, women, or the poor. Once exposed, ESG darlings could become dogs overnight, hurting investors and potentially sparking a financial crisis. Now, the second approach that a Friedman fund could take is typically frowned upon. According to the so-called Wall Street rule, investors who do not like management decisions should sell instead of raising a stink. But he says it's a good rule of thumb because corporate management is usually well entrenched and most stockholder proposals fail because managers dominate corporate elections due to their control of the proxy mechanism and employee-owned shares. So a few simple rule changes like cumulative voting, secret ballots, proxy mechanism reform, and larger board member and executive stock holdings would make it easier for individual shareholders and institutional investors to pressure management to maximize long-run stockholder returns by making more rational business decisions, like not alienating their median customer to please vocal extremists. Now, until then, Friedman funds have to be willing to purchase underachieving companies like Twitter through stock market purchase of controlling stakes, tender offers, or proxy votes. Yes, Robert Wright says such tactics are often derided as corporate raiding, but the poor state of corporate governance can render such raids economically necessary. In the 1980s and 90s, the takeover of poorly performing corporations by funds led by corporate raiders like Carl Icahn and leveraged buyout firms like Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts invigorated the U.S. economy by forcing rational changes at stagnating or inefficient companies. It's no accident that the classic film on corporate takeovers, Other People's Money, hit theaters in 1991. Its famous climax pitted Lawrence Larry the Liquidator Garfield, played by Danny DeVito, of Garfield Investments, against Andrew Jorgensen, played by Gregory Peck, head of the failing New England Wire and Cable Company, the biggest employer in a small Rhode Island town. At the company's annual stockholder meeting, Jorgensen argued, like every other adherent of the stakeholder theory of the corporation, a business is worth more than the price of its stock. It's the place where we earn our living, where we meet our friends, and dream our dreams. After being derided by Jorgensen as a greedy, big-city corporate raider who builds nothing and is basically committing murder, here's Garfield's retort. This company is dead. I didn't kill it. Don't blame me. It was dead when I got here. It's too late for prayers, for even if the prayers were answered and a miracle occurred, and the yen did this and the dollar did that and the infrastructure did the other thing, we would still be dead. You know why? Fiber optics, new technologies, obsolescence. We're dead, all right. We're just not broke. And you know the surest way to go broke? Keep getting an increasing share of a shrinking market down the tubes, slow and sure. Now, granted, Musk's play on Twitter is somewhat different. Unlike buggy whips, microblogging isn't a doomed industry yet. But clearly, Twitter, despite its sizable first-mover advantage, was losing market share to direct competitors like Parler, as well as newer social media concepts like Clubhouse and Mastodon. I'll have a link to this article in the show notes. Again, this is Robert E. Wright, Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. You'll learn a little something here. You might have to break out the dictionary to look up the terms you don't understand. I know I had to. But this is definitely a thought-provoking article, and maybe just one more way for a little common sense to prevail. Check it out in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com.
This is The Brian Hyde Show. This is The Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. If you're one of the thousands of people relocating to the Intermountain West, particularly if you are going to land in the state of Utah or the state of Idaho, you need to talk to my friend Heather Turner and her team at Patriot Home Mortgage. The Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage has the experience, the clout, and the stability to get you the loan you need without delay. And I would encourage you, get in touch with her by calling 435-703-4522. You can stop by her office in St. George, Utah. They're located at 619 South Bluff Street. Heather's NMLS ID is 715386, and Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. So I know I raised a little bit of blood pressure yesterday for a few folks by questioning whether you should vote at all. Does your voting really just set you up to be separated from your liberty? And I'm going to push a little bit today. This is an older article written by Brittine Schaefer, The Real Reason Libertarians Don't Matter. And while it stings because it really rings true in many ways. She says, I still hear some liberty advocates talking about how we can achieve freedom through the political system by electing the right representatives, getting good laws passed, etc. So she says, I thought I might want to dust off an old article from 2016 and put it out there again. It's her own explanation. She says, I think it's a pretty good one of why that can never work. So Brittine Schaefer writes, a Facebook friend recently asked principled, non-voting libertarians to explain their reasoning to her, to explain why, in this year of all years, when the libertarian candidate actually has a shot at winning, why they're withholding their votes. It's a reasonable question, and she says, I'm going to do my best to give her an answer with the qualification that while I've considered myself a principled non-voter in the past, I now consider myself a pragmatic one. Brittine Schaefer says, my stance on voting changed with Ron Paul's candidacy. I realized that I was willing to participate in a system I believed to be deeply wrong if it meant making a change that could save thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of lives by curtailing war, ending the war on drugs, and reining in some of the most unaccountable and harmful federal agencies. Now she says, I took a lot of flack for it from some principled libertarians for whom I have a great deal of respect, but she says, I do not regret my choice. I believed there was a real chance of accomplishing good. The bottom line for me was saving lives by voting. I trusted Dr. Paul based on a long track record of sticking to his principles to do his best to accomplish those things. And I acted on those beliefs. But Brittine Schaefer says, I see things a little differently now. I've had a closer look at how the system works, and I believe I have a better understanding of why this system of electing representatives, especially at the federal level, can never be an effective way of achieving liberty. Now, she says, to be clear, I'm talking specifically about electing people to office. I'm not dismissing the potential for local ballot initiatives to have an impact. In fact, we've seen the fruits of such initiatives in relaxing the medical marijuana laws across the country, which is a significant step for liberty. But ballot initiatives are a very different animal from elections for office, and an entire life form removed from those for the presidency. She says Jeff Tucker wrote recently of an encounter he had with someone high up in the Republican political campaign who contributed the absence of a libertarian angle in Republican campaigns to the fact that libertarians don't vote. Everyone knows that. That's why they don't matter. Now, she says Jeff's political beast was only half right. Yes, politicians running for office care about votes. But just as much as votes, indeed as a critical means of securing votes, they care about money. They care about campaign contributions, and they care about maintaining the relationships with the people, the corporations, and the other institutions that keep that money flowing to them. There is no law that can change this, or if you think there is, ask yourself who will be charged with enforcing that law, and then who controls that entity or entities. So here's the thing to understand. The things libertarians want: freedom, less government interference in markets and in personal choices, non-interventionist foreign policy. Yeah, there's no money in these things for politicians. There are no big corporations and very few rich people who are willing to pay tons of money to politicians to refrain from intervening in markets or to keep the troops home or to let the people ingest whatever substances they want to. In fact, it's just the opposite. Corporations have long been in the business of paying politicians to intervene in markets on their behalf, to erect barriers to competition, and in some cases to squash a particular competitor. Competition is wonderful for society as a whole, but it's not so great if you're one of the ones doing the competing. It's hard, and sometimes you lose. Sometimes, if you're big enough, it's just easier to send some money in the direction of people who can discover antitrust violations in your competitor's business practices. So Brittine Schaefer says, understand behind the empty campaign promises, politicians have essentially two things to offer to the people who support them. Number one, power in the form of regulatory and other control over competitors and others who may get in the way of a particular entity remaining comfortably profitable. Number two, money. Now, not their own money, of course, your money and my money, taken from us in taxes and in the continual devaluation of the government-issued money we all use. Politicians can give money to their supporters in the form of contracts for things like military equipment and public works projects, or in less direct ways, like mandating that government schools all stock epinephrine injectors that meet the same very specific product requirements that your device happens to meet. And the list goes on. What's not on this list, though, is liberty. Why? Because nowhere in this game is there an advantage to selling liberty. Now, she says, this point was driven home to me a few years ago when I asked a California senator's policy consultant if his boss would consider relaxing business restrictions as a way to help parents of children with special needs create the services they need. And she says he practically laughed at me. There was nothing in it for his boss or for his boss's supporters in reducing the very control that he uses to buy support. Now, Brittine Schaefer says, in theory, politicians could offer liberty to their supporters. They could offer to cut back regulations to end military aggression, but who's going to pay them for that? Again, these are things that would benefit everyone, all of society. But the game of politics is not about benefiting all of society. And the widely accepted belief that it is perhaps the most dangerous lie ever crafted. In order for a seeker of liberty to win at this game, that person would have to compete with the campaign donations and other inducements made by military contractors, major pharmaceutical companies, oil companies. But these are all entities that have been made rich by virtue of government interventions and direct largesse. How can a liberty seeker hope to offer the same level of financial inducements to politicians as these people, when they're not also on the receiving end of the government slush? So this is the real reason that libertarians don't matter in the political sphere. It's not because they don't vote. It's because they don't participate in the real game of politics, the interest-driven game that can never reward a player who wishes to dismantle the very engine of that game. People win at the game of politics by buying and selling political power over other people's lives and resources. And a player who wants to reduce that power will not find themselves rewarded within that game. They will find themselves spat out of it. That's why the political beasts are laughing at us. It's not because we don't vote. It's because we don't steal. And for these people, for people who never even question the morality of using state violence to get what they want, that's the biggest joke in the world. She says, that's why I don't believe it makes sense for a libertarian to vote. Voting is simply not a realm in which liberty wins. So the obvious question then from the person who wants me to vote is, why not do it anyway, though? In case you're wrong, what harm can it do? But here's the harm that it does. By perpetuating the lie that voting can be an effective way of advancing liberty, it helps direct people's energy and focus away from efforts that actually do have the potential to advance liberty. And she says, I'm not going to contribute to that. I'm not going to prop up the charade that we control our government or that it represents the people. She says, what people? What does that even mean? Which ones? The ones who disagree with each other? The government is owned by military contractors and pharmaceutical companies and a host of other concerns that are all feeding from that government trough in one way or another. None of this is going to be changed by voting, and the longer anyone pursues voting as a solution, the longer they are not seeking real solutions. I know, it's provocative. And it even raises my eyebrows, but I still think she's right. I'll have a link to Brittine Schaefer's article in my show notes. Check it out for yourself at thebrianhydeshow.com.
This is The Brian Hyde Show. This is The Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I want to thank lifesavingfood.com for being one of my sponsors. You know, a good food storage supply is a great source of peace of mind, particularly as you see food storage prices going up and hear about rumors of food shortages and other breakdowns in the supply chain. It's just nice to know that you have something on which you could fall back if a problem were to arise. In fact, it seems to make more sense every day. Click on the link I provide under my sponsors in my show notes, lifesavingfood.com. Peace of mind is ultimately what you're going to get. So why not grab some? Well, thank heaven for people who have developed a serious work ethic. And if you want to see a perfect example of what that looks like, you can look no further than Fred Astaire and his dance skills. This is an article from M.B. Matthews, published on AmericanThinker.com. M.B. Matthews says, as I watch old Fred Astaire movies, I was struck by the sheer perfection of his movements and his flawless syncopation. I had the conscious thought that America would be so much better off if Fred Astaire's work ethic and search for perfection were applied to our own culture. One Fred Astaire dance in particular stands out as the quintessence of hard work and purity of effort. Putting on the Ritz. Astaire in his iconic top hat and tails takes the music and reshapes it to his dance. He doesn't merely dance to the music dances to him. With almost 4 million views, and this is linked in the article, this clip is quintessentially Astaire. It is sheer perfection. Effortlessly, or so it appears, he moves every part of body and mind using a cane as a prop to create a syncopated flow that's sublime and strikes the appreciative viewer somewhere way back in the lizard brain. It is primitive while being sophisticated beyond belief. According to John Mueller, an American political scholar and expert on the dance, the wow factor in putting on the Ritz is use of delayed rhythmic resolution, a staggering off-balance passage emphasized by the unorthodox stresses in the lyric, suddenly resolves satisfyingly on a held note, followed by the forceful assertion of the title phrase. Mueller's description is a long way of saying that what Astaire did in this particular number was impossible in anyone else's hands or feet. Astaire created from whole cloth a way of dancing that forevermore would have his elegance stamped on it. Now, M.B. Matthews says, reading Astaire's autobiography is revealing. While not a great literary work, it wasn't meant to be. It was simply and honestly his childhood vaudeville story with his sister in a stage act that traced from when they were small children to when he struck out on his own. He later went on to Hollywood to dance with the most beautiful and talented actresses of those days. Ginger Rogers was not his only dance partner. There were other beauties like Rita Hayworth, Eleanor Powell, Leslie Caron, and Sid Charisse with her sultry litheness. Opinions differ as to who was his best partner. I think M.B. Matthews would probably come down on the side of Ginger. Fred Astaire's work ethic was almost pathological. He worried some of his dances to death by rehearsing them scores of times, sometimes to the point where Ginger Rogers' feet were bleeding. To say he was a perfectionist is to minimize his modus operandi. He micromanaged everything because he rightly surmised that no one knew better than he what would work best. Now, Astaire directed the people doing the filming of his dances never to shoot anything but full body shots because it interfered with the flow of the dance. And he was right. Astaire also curled his middle fingers while dancing because he felt they were too long. Such attention to detail, in addition to his God-given gift, made him the best dancer of any time in our history. There's never been another Fred Astaire, and while Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, two wonderful dancers of the same period, were excellent, they were different. M.B. Matthews says, dance-wise, I can think of no 21st century dancers of Astaire's genre and accomplishment, except perhaps Derek Hough, who has the control and talent to come close in movement, if not in style. Not even Mikhail Baryshnikov said he looked to Fred Astaire for inspiration. He said, no dancer can watch Fred Astaire and not know that we should all have been in another business. Wow, that's quite a compliment. So if you view our culture across all lines of endeavor, you may notice that people are succeeding and rising to the top of professions and businesses and entertainment with little going for them except a coarseness that demands you pay attention. The Fred Astaire ethic of working a problem from every angle 100 times if necessary in order to make it the very best it can be is gone. In its place are expediency, greed, sloth, lust for power, and a total lack of reasonable solutions. Would that we had some Fred Astaires in our government and in our agencies. Perhaps something would actually get done that helps Americans rather than hurts them, and it would be far more appealing to watch. The lessons of Fred Astaire loom large. A return to a strong work ethic and the courage to work a problem to an effective and salutary solution is in order. M.B. Matthews says, I look forward to the day when we wrest control of our country from the no-talents, the non-thinkers, the inept strategists, and give them to people who have actual solutions instead of all the tap dancing we're seeing now. By the way, if you get nothing else from this article, click on the link that takes you to Fred Astaire dancing, putting on the Ritz. It will be a welcome break from all the, you know, drama and turmoil of the day, all the carnage out there, and hopefully put you in a good frame of mind just to appreciate that there have been some really excellent human beings. Fred Astaire was one of them, and I'm sure there are such individuals today. But if you want to see what a real work ethic looks like and you want to appreciate it for what it can do, this is a great place to start. All right, a little bonus material for you here. How would you know the signs of a false flag? And I'm bringing this up because I'm hearing, you know, talk, the more conspiracy-minded among us are always looking for some angle. And you know, sometimes it's true. Sometimes this could be the case. So it's not like, oh, they're always wrong. They're not. I think sometimes you can turn, you know, searching for conspiracy theories into kind of a waste of time. But when the young man shot up the Buffalo supermarket over the weekend, there's a lot about that just played so perfectly into the hands of politicians, you know, and they're, of course, using this to full advantage. They're out there, you know, making the stump speeches and waving the bloody shirt and trying, you know, to get people energized, you know, to demonize their opponents because they all obviously were in lockstep with this young murderous man. And so at some level, I think you do have to ask the question, is it possible? Could this have been some kind of false flag? Anytime people in power start to find themselves in trouble, I always wonder, well, when are we going to see the false flag? Now, maybe that's just being cynical, but if you're looking to know, what would the signs of a false flag be? This is from Robert Barnes, and I think these actually are some pretty good rules of thumb. Number one, it asks you to respond emotionally rather than intellectually. Number two, a false flag will strip, or reporting on a false flag will strip the event of context, such as contemporary factual setting or geopolitical reality or even historical awareness. Number three, it demands a rush to judgment before a diligent, independent inquiry occurs. This is one of the reasons why I have developed the practice, and I encourage my listeners, do not jump on the bandwagon and start chanting in unison with everybody until you've had a chance to really vet things and see if this is real. And know that I think this because I choose to think this, not because someone told me to. Number four, it collectivizes judgment by taking an individual event and demands you blame an entire culture, religion, race, ancestry, community, or country for it. I mean, for crying out loud, you've got the President of the United States essentially demonizing half the voters in the country as being in lockstep with a murderous white supremacist. Number five, the only explicable motive offered for the offending action is irrational evil or utterly stupid immorality, as it is against the rational interest of the offender to commit the act for the reasons alleged. These are the five signs of a false flag, again from Robert Barnes. Worth considering. I'd especially pay attention if you are being asked to respond emotionally rather than intellectually. Pay extra close attention. I pointed this out before. Mass shootings, we tend to think, oh, they're happening everywhere because, you know, because the news media is hyper-focused on it. And there's that availability bias. Well, if I'm seeing it in the news, it must be happening everywhere. But it's not. And any time a mass shooting does happen, politicians know they have a very limited window of opportunity to get people engaged emotionally. People are going to be thinking poorly. They're going to be looking at the tragedy. They're going to be angry. They're going to be fearful. But that window of opportunity closes and rational thought returns fairly quickly. This is why politicians are very quick to gin up, you know, a lynch mob of sorts. We don't have time to think. Something has to be done. And this is when they're at their most dangerous. So, I'll have a link to this in the show notes. Check it out for yourself. Signs of a false flag. It's not going to make you impervious to their propaganda, but you'll be better at spotting it, and that's a good start.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. I love my sponsors, and I appreciate the fact that they make it possible for me to do this program to daily find the best information I can and then share it with you. And among those sponsors, HSL Ammo is one of whom I'm very, very proud. HSL Ammo is located in St. George, Utah. They make high-quality new and remanufactured ammunition. As I've mentioned before, ammunition is a great thing, not only as a commodity and a store of value. So if you're looking at ways to convert your money into something that's tangible, you can actually put your hands on and that will hold value, would be good for barter and things like this, it's a pretty safe bet. But there's also the prospect of turning your money into skill, and I mean skill at arms. There's just no substitute for being able to go to the shooting range or to go get training. These things require ammunition. HSL Ammunition is a proud supporter of the Second Amendment. They help people become responsible gun owners and shooters. You can click on the link I provide in my show notes. Go to their website. If you see something you need, please consider buying it from hslammo.com. Well, I'm not trying to sound paranoid here, but if you are serious about your freedom, I'm guessing that at some point, you've asked the question, are they really out to get me? Got a great article here from Jeff Thomas from internationalman.com. And he says, the answer is yes and no. But I want you to hear his explanation. He says, libertarians and others who seek to be left alone to run their lives habitually ask themselves the question, are they really out to get me regarding their government? And he says, so what's the answer? Are they out to get you? Well, unfortunately, the answer isn't a simple yes or no. In fact, it's yes and no. The secret to understanding a government's intentions is that there's no unified overall objective, sentiment, or approach to dealing with the private sector. Quite the opposite. With any government, it couldn't be more fragmented or dysfunctional. So at the very lowest level of any government is the civil service, which is, in any country, a catch-all for those people who are so lacking in ability and imagination that they'd be unlikely to hold down a job in the private sector. Moreover, their level of motivation is likely to be so low that their dysfunction tends to coincide with extreme inefficiency. Now, to test that out, he says you just have to go visit the local Department of Motor Vehicles or a similar agency that does little except charge fees and waste time in order to provide you with a permit, which, if it were not required, you could happily do without. and most anyone in observing the individual behind the counter would observe the glassy stare and recognize that even though this person spends each working day behind this counter and may have been doing so for years, he or she takes virtually no interest in your personal concerns. And if you have questions, tends to find them a nuisance and an interruption in the endless drudgery of issuing paperwork. So there's a picture of an airplane, and it's a pilot in Canada who, being presented with a computer-driven list of tail letters that were authorized for him to choose from, immediately laughed when he saw the letters on the list. He went up to the counter, circled the ones he chose, and the clerk processed the application brainlessly without even registering in his head what those letters suggested. I'm not going to say them because it's a little bit vulgar, but it definitely says F them in so many letters. Later, when the pilot had the letters emblazoned on his fuselage, it might not have been unlikely that an airport supervisor, seeing those 10-inch-high letters on the side of his plane, raised an objection, at which time the pilot proudly produced his paperwork. As most anyone in the private sector can attest, as soon as the paperwork is presented, the civil servant in question simply says, "Oh," and then nods and lets you go on your way. But looking at this more deeply, what we're witnessing is that that percentage of the population who are once again lacking in ability and imagination are easy to program by the government to become automatons. That even if something strikes them as being somehow incorrect, as long as it has the state stamp of approval, well, then it's just fine. So at the lower level of government, we have those who are not out to get us. They're just merely borderline useless and have ended up with jobs in which that deficiency will not get them fired. They are, therefore, merely in the way. But as we go up the chain, however, where those in government are somewhat more ambitious, we find a greater desire to control. In fact, the closer we get to the higher echelons, the more truly they are out to get you. Jeff Thomas says, why should this be? And why should it be that the higher-ups tend to hate the most, those that are self-motivated, responsible, self-reliant, and imaginative? Well, unfortunately, he says the answer is simple. It's because those are the character traits that they lack. Jeff Thomas says, I'm sorry to have to say that in my many years of working directly with politicians and heads of governments, virtually all of them were highly evolved civil servant types. They had more drive, more guile, and larger egos than the lower-level bureaucrats, but they were just as parasitical and just as lacking in character traits that would make them productive people. With these individuals, he says, yes, they are out to get you. First, if they recognize that you possess traits that would make you productive, they will be highly jealous and suspicious of you. Second, they will understand that since you are productive and they are not, they must find a means by which they can use you as a cash cow to be milked as much as possible and as often as possible. So their purpose, therefore, is to regulate, control, and tax you in every way possible. And in this, they're quite simply predators. They may be Tory or Labor, Republican or Democrat, but they are predators nonetheless. And as such, they are a genuine threat to both your freedom and your well-being. Now, of course, all politicians play the game of party politics, doing all in their power to convince the electorate that they and their party are dramatically different from the opposing party, presenting their own party as the good guys and the opposing party as the bad guys. However, they are, as Judge Andrew Napolitano has repeatedly stated, merely two wings of the same bird of prey. Significantly, as both the top, or rather the bottom level and top level, are separated by many other layers of bureaucracy, and as their common character traits are inability, dysfunction, etc., there's no cohesive set of principles upon which a government operates. Its purposes are control and usurpation, and they're backed by an imbroglio of confused and self-contradictory legislation and an increasingly large body of enforcement agencies. And although the individuals within these agencies tend to be incompetent and dysfunctional, they do tend to remain loyal to the whole. They may not get along with each other or work toward a unified set of goals or even have the same beliefs. They do, however, tend to do as they're told and blindly support the state above all else. Once all the above is grasped, he says, the individual may do as this pilot has done. He's grasped the dysfunction and parasitical nature of his government and has used their own computer-generated registration code to express his reaction to their authority. More to the point, he has used their laws, their bureaucracy, to express it legally. Now, that's an important point. Each individual essentially has three choices. He can either go along with those lesser beings who seek to control his life, or he can rebel and possibly be incarcerated for his efforts, or he can become creative and recognize that the laws and regulation of his country are a confused mess written by incompetent people and do all he can to assert his independence legally. Jeff Thomas says he can and should do everything in his power to operate his life as though he's not owned by the government of his home country or any other government for that matter. Whenever a government tries to control the ownership of his real estate through taxation, he might seek out a jurisdiction that has no property tax. When they try to tax his income, he might seek out a country that has no income tax. If they try to restrict his migration, he might seek a second citizenship that does not restrict him. The point here is, freedom is not merely a vague historical idea or an excuse to celebrate with firecrackers once a year. It's a lifetime pursuit and should be taken on as such. Now, the pilot in question has made an initial stab at it. Hopefully, he, along with others, like you, the reader, will make it a central facet of his life's work. And I do like that approach there. Freedom is not just, you know, well, we invoke it around election time. It's primary election day where I live right now. And, you know, the election fever and political fever is running pretty high. And it gets a lot of people really, you know, on board with freedom. But it seems like their interest ebbs as the day comes and goes. It's kind of like the 4th of July. We talk about it. We play a few patriotic songs and, you know, give it some lip service. But it really should be a central facet of your life's work. That doesn't mean that you need to, you know, dedicate yourself to, I'm going to be a columnist, I'm going to be a talk show host, or I'm going to go out there and talk about it every day. It just means you have to consistently make it a priority. Find ways to live as freely as possible in a very clearly unfree world. But the main thing you have to remember is, you don't need to ask permission to do so. In fact, asking permission is probably the worst way to go about it, because the people who want to control you are not about to give you permission to do things without their license. They won't do it. So act like a free man or woman. Seize your freedom. Go out there and make the difference you were born to make.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.